Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
On today's Fresnolandia, we have the first of what we hope will be several conversations to dive into the California High-Speed Rail Project and what its future holds for Fresno. Today, we have with us Egon Terplan, who is a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Institute for Transportation Studies. He's also a former senior advisor to Governor Gavin Newsom, working on the High-Speed Rail Project and economic development initiatives for the state, and was a former regional planning director for SPUR, which is a Bay Area think tank. Egon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Egon, I wanted to start with kind of a broad question, which is, can you talk about how the vision of high-speed rail has evolved over time? I think there was a lot of idealism to start, and then the kind of the reality of the complications of the project set in, and how has that changed people's vision for the project in general?
Well, thanks, Jordan. It's a great question to start with. It's probably relevant to step back and say, why do we need high-speed rail? What's the purpose of high-speed rail? Where did this come from? And it's relevant to think about. California has been or was for many years a fast-growing state with tremendous mobility, large metropolitan regions. If you think about the 20-plus million people in Southern California, the 4 or 5 million folks in the Central Valley and growing, 8-9 million people in the Bay Area, big areas with lots of economic activity, lots of connection between them. And as we know, lots of cars, lots of congestion, many airports getting congested, lots of delays. So why do you want trains? One very core reason you want trains is they are much more reliable than flying. They're much faster than flying when you add in all of the getting to the airport, waiting, security. They're a lovely way to get around. We know that from many other parts of the world. And so it was a very big theory of change and a big way for California to not only get places better, but also to have better economic integration between places. That, as we know, and this is particularly true for the Central Valley, because if you want to have a meeting and you're in Fresno and you want to get to the Bay Area, it takes up many hours. But if you can hop on a train and get there in an hour, it's a lot easier and faster. And similarly, connection to Southern California. So high-speed rail, the vision was connect the major economic regions of the state on a fast train that's also very clean, that's electrified. And so it was also part of California's vision to mitigate its impact of climate change and have a totally carbon neutral transportation system. Now, how did it change? The first big question was, how do you get between the Bay Area and the Central Valley? And that there were multiple theories. From the initial thinking about high-speed rail, some people proposed a route from the Bay Area to Southern California along I-5. And if you live in the Central Valley, you know that I-5 is on the far western side of the valley floor. So that would bypass the existing cities and the center of their communities. So the one first big change was a bunch of people got together and said, you know what, if we're going to do this, it ought to go through the center of Fresno, center of Bakersfield, and connect those cities to each other and to the coastal cities. So that's, in a sense, change number one. Change number two is how we paid for it. And so we started in 2008, and it's an idea that goes back before 2008, but in 2008, we had a bond measure that was a $10 billion bond, of which about $8 or $9 billion was for high-speed rail, and some of the other funding was for related investments. Many people thought that was enough to get through that, and I would say the folks involved with rail didn't think it was, but I think the public got this sense. That was the down payment, that was the public investment, that would be enough. It never was enough. These big projects are complicated, take a lot of time. And so when high-speed rail was then able to get a portion of the state's cap and trade funds, these are the funds paid by polluters on an annual basis. The price goes up and down, but it's a sense, it's a sort of a price to pollute, but the money is supposed to go into investments that reduce our climate impacts. High-speed rail then was getting 25% of those auctions on each time an auction went forward. That was another big change because that gave high-speed rail a kind of dedicated amount of money going forward. But by and large, we have been pursuing the vision of the phase one project from the Bay Area through the Central Valley to Anaheim for a little bit more than the past decade. And so we've reasonably been on that course for the last decade plus.
When you look back at a lot of your writing that you've done early on in the project, you had a report that came out when you were still at SPUR in 2012, where you laid out sort of a vision for the design and the financing. what was missing, or what in your thinking was missing at that time that would change your mind about how the project has been implemented so far?
I think that we never committed enough to an ongoing funding stream that was sufficient for the scale of the project is one thing I would say. And that's why I wanted to talk about the bond and the measures. So I don't think we ever quite fully to ourselves, to the public, really said how complicated and expensive these sorts of projects are. A second piece that we didn't do that I think in retrospect we maybe should have done is look at the layers of environmental reviews and processes and the California Environmental Quality Act that applied to this project. We had talked about that. We considered it, but that point was too late. We were already deep in the environmental review process. A lot of people would look back and say, was there a different way to do environmental reviews? One that would have been a lot cheaper and a lot less expensive. Billions probably have been spent on environmental impact reports on this project, if you go back.
Do you think the litigation that's resulted from that has been a bigger inhibitor, or the environmental review process and the cost of it?
I think both, they're related. But if we think about litigation, litigation is always going to happen on big infrastructure projects. When water was brought from the Sierra Nevada into the East Bay, there was lots of litigation by the individuals that the water pipeline was going to be going through. Because high-speed rail went on the 99 corridor instead of the I-5 corridor, there were many more landowners to deal with. So by definition, by choosing that route, it was going to be more complicated. It was more complicated. There was more litigation, there was more negotiations, and it cost more money and took more time. Now, I would argue, and interesting for those listening, was that trade-off the right trade-off? If you want a station in Fresno, it is. Otherwise, you wouldn't get a station in Fresno. But I think absolutely that the complexity of moving through all those different communities with so many different property owners led to more litigation.
I think that's a good segue to the next question I have, and you and I have talked about this a little bit, Egon, which is when high-speed rail was introduced to Fresno and the route was shifted to the 99 corridor, there was a lot of work done to talk about how high-speed rail would reshape the economic geography of the state, and certainly for Fresno, in the way that the rail system reshaped our economic geography in the 19th century, and then the freeway system and I-5 certainly has reshaped the geography again. High-speed rail would do the same. We would see tech companies relocate to Fresno. People would move here. People would get higher wage jobs. And I'm just curious, you've talked and studied a lot about this. What still holds true for that theory that high-speed rail will dramatically change our ability to attract more higher wage jobs to Fresno?
This is the critical question. It's one of the reasons we certainly do this. And I think this is one where there's a lot of like misnomers or misunderstanding about it. The first thing is we're not going to really know until it's up and running. And then you actually see behavior. So we need to start with that assumption. But also let's look at what's happened over the last couple of years to Fresno. There's been a lot of folks have moved, bought homes. The remote work change has enabled a set of investments in Fresno real estate that people might not have assumed in 2018, 2017, and before. So we've already been through a little bit of an experiment of what happens when a place is functionally more economically integrated, but that was virtual, not physical. So what additional change will happen? I think that's really depends a lot on a couple of things. One, what does Fresno do around its station? What is the place like in downtown? What kinds of companies are there? What kinds of university buildings? What kind of research institutes? What kind of attractions are going to bring people there? Because ultimately, you're coming to the station to get to the whole variety of activities within the city, but it's also that immediate area, that surrounding city environment that's critical. Similarly, on the other end, right? What's Diridon Station in San Jose like? What's happening in the Bakersfield Station? How much economic activity is there in downtown Los Angeles around Union Station? Trains are part of a network. And so this is why land use and stationary development is such a critical part of making it successful. And so it's not, you can have a theory about what might happen, but you also then need a set of people that are making decisions and choices at the local area that bring economic activity and other destinations close to that station.
And I think something that I've been thinking about as I talk to people about high-speed rail is, you mentioned the remote work shifts that we saw during COVID. For folks in Fresno, that basically saw a lot of people come here from the Bay and LA who helped jack up our housing prices, both rents and if you want to buy a home, and didn't necessarily bring a lot of jobs and didn't necessarily uplift the downtown in a way that I think people thought that would happen. And so I think people are now, when they hear, oh, high-speed rail is going to bring more connectivity, what they hear is, oh, our housing prices are going to get more expensive. And so the land use component that you're talking about is really important, but we haven't seen that will in Fresno to constrain the growth forces to urbanized areas instead of allowing sprawl. So do you think that the state will ever step in a more significant way to make sure that those really important decisions around locating universities and economically important functions are happening near the station?
I will say, I certainly hope so. And that's one of what an argument that we've made for many years, and I made when we were in the governor's office, we'd have to think about high-speed rail as this major infrastructure investment that needs a lot of other state policies and actions to really succeed, and local actions. But let's talk a little bit about Fresno here, because I actually think the geography kind of matters. And if you think about Fresno, the state, a lot of the growth has been to the north. What I didn't say earlier when you asked about what has changed, one thing that's changed is there is now a proposal for a station stop in Madera County. There had not been, that it was not one of the initial stations. And so what that means is that for a lot of people in Fresno, in the northern part of Fresno, and a lot of the growth that's happening just across the river in Madera County, the Madera station is going to be closer to you than downtown Fresno. So that changes a little bit the equation about where you live in Fresno to get access to the train. And so, and let's, we have to play this out over the next, you know, number of years of how, you know, what the choices people will make, but that's a little different. And it's one of the only places in the state where you're going to have two stations that could functionally impact where people live within one metropolitan region. Bakersfield just has one station. Sure, the Bay Area might have San Jose and San Francisco, but those are 60 miles apart.
All right. Let's talk about international comparisons. A few years ago, I read this great book called How Big Things Get Done. It looked at a bunch of kind of big international projects. And there was a lot in the book about high-speed rail, and it looked at different examples in other places and how things were done more efficiently. And one of the things that was brought up in the book was the fact that, and this was part of the criticism, that there wasn't enough, while there was the leads on high-speed rail looked to international projects, they didn't actually employ some of these companies to help with the project who'd actually done it in practice. So how do you think about international examples? How do you think about how we should use them? And what do you think of that criticism that we needed more companies that had actually accomplished these in other places as opposed to hiring local companies?
So let's start with kind of what do we learn and why do we look at other places? I think we look at other places because you want to understand motivations and what was successful in arguments and also what happens over time. And so let's just spend a little bit on that and then we can talk about the individuals involved. There is, so in Japan, high-speed rail has been around for decades. It's been extremely effective. Hundreds of millions of trips are taken on it. It's extremely fast. The train companies are penalized if they're more than, you know, 40 or 50 seconds late. It's extremely efficient. There's extremely high density across the Japanese cities. But one of the things it's done is concentrated more economic activity in Tokyo. So a question always with high-speed rail has been, does it benefit the big cities and big metropolitan regions more so than the stations in between? And this is particularly important for Fresno, because Fresno is not a small place, but it's smaller than the Los Angeles region and the Bay Area. Would it be something that makes it easy to get from Fresno to the Bay Area, or does it make it easy for companies to invest in Fresno and bring the jobs there? And to this, there is evidence in both directions throughout the world. But I think that's important to look at. And I'll just say quickly, what makes the difference? I think what makes the difference for the in-between stations is really the types of choices you make right around your station. Is there a university that puts a bunch of buildings there that is growing? Is there a research institute attached to the university? And I'm focusing on those kinds of efforts because office buildings are important. They can be part of it. But one thing that people do in person today and will do in person in the future is go to class, work at a research facility. Those are the kinds of activities we know are going to be in person. A lot of office work, yes, it's important to be in person, but that we know from more recent years is easier to shift online. So it's not guaranteed that more traditional office space will lead to a bunch of activities. And students take the train a bunch. So that's the kind of thing and Lille, France is a great example of this. It's at that midpoint between Paris and Brussels and then London. It's the place where the train comes through all three of those directions. Huge ridership, a lot of development around the station, and it's a big university town. So high-speed rail has had lots of great analysis and work from folks who worked internationally. Foster and Partners have provided really interesting thinking on station planning. They're involved with the architecture today. Deutsche Bahn, the Germans that are involved in the German rail system have been involved. There's been a lot of guidance. One consideration is that these experts have come in and they provided great work, but the project has evolved and changed a little bit. There's been changes in leadership. And so I think it's been difficult at times to take all that information and have a very clear single strategy going forward. And so we've started to go in certain directions. And I think thinking about stations is one example where we're now at a point where there's some really great station area planning work happening. It's informed by a lot of these international examples. Any challenge I would put to our friends at the state is, will the state legislature, for example, provide some of the tools needed to help realize that vision? You can have all the best expertise in the world advising high-speed rail authority. But if that expertise says, hey, what would be really important is a tool that helps unlock the value of the investment, and you need something like a value capture tool and some growth of the property tax that can be reinvested locally so that you can build some significant infrastructure to support the rail investment, or you need the rail entity to own enough land that it can become a real estate developer itself and have some of the money from those leases flow back to the rail system. That's what they do in Hong Kong and many places that don't need a subsidy at all to run the trains. Well, you need the legislature to allow the High-Speed Rail Authority to do that. I think the expertise has to be combined within the political will in the state to implement some of those concepts.
And I think that just goes back to this question that I have of, we have a very local first philosophy when it comes to land use in California. And while we've seen a lot of investment from the state in downtown Fresno around the station area and high-speed rail has certainly attracted a lot of state investment. Fresno has been the recipient or promised recipient of up to $300 million in state funding to really build out some of the infrastructure around the high-speed rail station. We're still seeing some project delivery challenges locally because the actors are so fragmented. Decision-making is fragmented. You have to corral a lot of landowners. The same issues that are miring the project at large at a really small scale around the station. And so what you said, that decision and will with the lawmakers is really important, but we're at a place in the project where the sort of public will around the project is potentially at risk. So what do you think would turn that around at this point? What does the project need to recapture public sentiment again?
I think the public in California and in many parts of the country is frustrated at how difficult it is for us to do big things. Frustrated by a system where they hear some promise, but then many years later, they still haven't seen it. And we're starting to see a lot of people nationally write about this and write about this kind of, in a sense, we've built a regulatory state that tries to really constrain the actions of government, because for many decades in the mid-20th century, governments with public investment were doing things we wanted that were harming communities. Highways mowing down neighborhoods, particularly working class communities and communities of color. And we wanted to constrain the powers of government to do that. Now, those same rules still apply. And so when you're trying to build a big train project, it's the same set of complexities. And whether it's a set of environmental laws or kind of public involvement, and they're good support behind it, but it slows things down. I think what the public wants to see is forward progress. And so what a couple of things may give me some hope now, and I think we need to do a better job sharing these things. One, high-speed rail starting to lay track, right? That wasn't happening before, but the physical manifestation of seeing some track in the ground is important. Two, having the long-term funding commitment, and it has been helpful, but we're at a moment right now where there's a conversation again of will high-speed rail continue to get the funding from the cap and trade dollars? And so I think that is one, if we do steps and, you know, move forward one step and two steps back, we're not going to be able to actually see the success in the end of the day. So I think having the funding commitment is a second piece of it. And vision, or the public's, here, let me restate that. Yeah, the public has a right to see forward progress and wants to see forward progress. And so it is incumbent on us and those of us involved to demonstrate that, to see more actual construction and the laying of the track. Now, high-speed rail took many years. The entire alignment is environmentally cleared. We actually now are at a point where we can start going more quickly than we have been. And we need to tell the story of what will happen over time. And so one of the things high-speed rail is now saying is that the connection into the Bay Area to Los Angeles, yeah, it's still a few more years, but we can imagine that over 15 or 20 years. That is a time frame that is far longer than anyone wants, but it's at least putting a marker out there that wasn't there before.
Do you think it's been harmful to the project to have constant timelines that have been broken for various reasons? I personally think that's one of the ways we've broken public trust on the project, is the timeline has shifted so many times. And so what would it look like if politicians and the authority just said, look, it's going to take 20 years, guys. This is just how it's going to go. Do you think that would help alleviate the public concern, or do you think people would sour on it completely?
No, I do. And I think that this is, if we go back in time and think about decisions that were made, one decision that could have been made but wasn't was to build this incrementally by upgrading existing rail. Now, there's a train through the Central Valley on Amtrak ridership on the San Joaquin, and the San Joaquins is pretty high by national standards. So there already is a train connecting these cities. High-speed rail was starting from scratch to build a totally new alignment. Why? Because the current train is sharing tracks with the freight rail, and is much slower, and it certainly could never be high speed. But a version of looking in the past could have taken that existing alignment and tried to add segments onto it to make the full Bay Area to Los Angeles happen first. But we all know the focus of the investment was initially in the Central Valley. And so that it was more complicated and harder to do for a bunch of the reasons we've talked about. And so the public hasn't seen it, but I'm using that as an example of, yes, if we had leveraged the existing train and done the upgrades and focused on the pieces that we don't have, I think we would be in a different place. Now, here's where we are. And I think this is actually the real question for Californians, for Americans, for all sorts of, here's where we are. We can go back and criticize and litigate, but going forward, do we think having an electric train throughout California is still something we want to have for the 21st century? Do we want to demonstrate that we have the capacity as a society to deliver on big projects? I think a lot of Californians are going to say, yes, we do. The second question becomes, is it still worth it? Do we still have trust and faith that it can happen? And I actually think we have a critical window in the next couple of years to demonstrate some significant forward movement. And I think people are going to shift. And then, of course, once it opens, that's a whole different game show. But we have to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about potential or hypothetical riders. When you imagine someone commuting on the train from Fresno to San Francisco, is this going to be I'm imagining like a teacher in Cupertino who can't afford to buy a home, and so then they commute into the Bay Area? What do you imagine when you think about a potential rider on this train who's living maybe in the Central Valley and commuting to coastal areas?
So I actually don't think commuting is really a big part of this. And so I think it's something where people don't commute significant distances generally. Most people's commutes are 25, 30 minutes. Some people have longer commutes if they live in a dense city like New York and they ride transit. And certainly some people have long commutes in the automobile because of housing costs. But in general, hour and a half commutes are the outliers. They're not the norm. And I don't think we should be planning high-speed rail for a teacher in Cupertino to live in Fresno. However, I do think that we think of all the people in Fresno who fly out of SFO to go other places. Taking the train to SFO, transferring, and then getting on the airplane, that's going to be a much, much better way to get around, particularly if you're going overseas. So that's a piece of ridership. Obviously, a piece of ridership are the people that have business meetings in one city or the other. Remember, this also goes to Anaheim. There's a set of people who are going to be taking this for holiday, to go to Disneyland, to go to other places where actually you don't need a car. And so anytime you do ridership models, you have to look at these, you got to take segments. And nothing is, it doesn't have to be for everyone, right? It doesn't have to be. What you have to do is have a train that's going to provide enough frequency with enough, it's got to be time competitive with driving and time competitive with everything else and cost competitive. But there's not going to be a kind of specific ideal rider. Another piece of ridership that I think we haven't talked enough about are our university students, graduate students, and researchers. So think about just in the Central Valley between UC Merced, Fresno State, and CSU Bakersfield. You've got tens of thousands of people involved in research, taking classes. Imagine that we said, hey, all students at CSU and UCs have a free pass on high-speed rail that's part of your tuition. And you can take courses between the different universities up and down the corridor. So you could live in Bakersfield and take a class that you go up for the afternoon and spend the afternoon in Fresno and then make it back to Bakersfield. So I think that's a piece of how we have to be just a little bit more creative in our thinking. That happens in other places. That's not a kind of a crazy new idea. So it's not just about the inland to coast. I think it's also about up and down these economic relationships within the valley that can be critically important.
I want to talk about the world in which high-speed rail doesn't happen in the valley and in the state, because that is still an option on the table as the Trump administration is looking to potentially pull federal funding, and we may not have a federal partner, at least for the next few years. And we're having this debate locally about where future funding for the project will come from the state. And for a lot of folks who haven't been in Fresno in the last several years, our city has been entirely upended by high-speed rail construction. It's really hard to go anywhere downtown, Chinatown. My commute to work daily comes through high-speed rail construction. Everywhere you go on every freeway, there's pylons welcoming you as you enter into the city. And so I think people forget that aren't from Fresno how much it has impacted our daily lives already. And so the question of if high-speed rail goes away is not hypothetical to us. It's what are we going to do with all this infrastructure? So what are we going to do if we don't have high-speed rail? And what are the prospects that Fresno has if in terms of transforming our economic geography and bringing more high-wage jobs to Fresno if we don't have a train? What does that look like for us?
Yeah, I think there's a much... Okay, so first is like you have all this infrastructure. The good news is that infrastructure can be used as we continue. Even if there's a pause for a moment, I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we really think that countries are not going to have trains in the 21st century? And if the answer is no, trains actually are still pretty important in the 21st century, then I think even if there's a pause, it's eventually going to be built. All right. So we have to, like, if we have a much longer term view, and just to give an example, in the 1960s, when the Bay Area was talking about building a rail system that became BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, there was a big debate at that time. Oh, why don't we just do this with buses? We just have buses, have lanes on highways, can get out to all these places. It'll be a lot cheaper. Yeah, it probably would have been cheaper, but it wouldn't have been as permanent. It wouldn't have been as structurally important. The buses would be stuck in traffic. And now, 50 plus years after the creation of BART, I don't think people would say, oh, I wish we hadn't done that in the past. The same is true for high-speed rail. So I think that we have to give ourselves a much longer-term view of that. And it's unfortunate the impacts, the direct impacts on the inability to cross roads. And there's probably a bunch of decisions that high-speed rail could have done better to make it more convenient to get around. And that's maybe a different conversation about sort of the scale of the infrastructure that we did, which might, you know, maybe we could have done it in a more incremental way. That said, in the near term, no matter what happens with high-speed rail, the same ideas about having a great downtown, having activities that are there concentrating your existing economic activities in the downtown absolutely should be done, right? I don't think this is one of the kind of core themes of high-speed rail isn't about hanging your future on connecting to another place. It's actually on making your place a great place that people want to come to and connect to anyway. And so all the things, and I think that what's been, people have talked about moving into ag tech and the future of food, and there's a kind of an initiative around that, thinking about the opportunities in clean energy that can be done locally, irrespective of what happens at the federal government. A lot of the work that we were involved in, the governor's office was thinking about these different diverse regional economies and continuing to grow them. That's what Fresno should be doing, no matter what happens with a train. And now, but locally, some of that infrastructure, I think that we also have to think about interim uses around those stations and activating them. And so this is something, again, where one very specific idea we know from other places is think a place manager, right? Of kind of thinking about someone who wakes up every morning thinking about how to make that place work. And once you get that station up and running, but the marketing and branding, the communications, is it a clean and safe environment? Having a vision around the leasing, the activities. And I know that the Downtown Business Improvement District is thinking that way around Fulton Corridor, but that's the type of activity downtowns need. And we should just continue full speed ahead in that process.
We have built massive infrastructure projects in California before. The interstate highway system here, the Central Valley Project, the State Water Project. So why has it seemed, at least from the public eye, that high-speed rail has been so much more difficult to implement than those other massive infrastructure projects that we've built in the past?
In recent years, high-speed rail is definitely the biggest infrastructure project proposed in California and across the country. And as a result, it has the greatest amount of attention. And so as we are in the middle of a time in the United States, all across the country, where not only are all types of infrastructure projects more expensive than they used to be, much more expensive than they are relative to other countries, including neighboring countries like Canada, right? Oftentimes two or three times more expensive, or at least 50%, depending on the project, the transit project, the sewage line. We do things more expensively in the United States. We're slower at it. That is true also for high-speed rail. High-speed rail just happens to be bigger than anything else. So it has a big target on its back. It's much easier to critique. But when a 5-mile highway widening comes in twice as expensive as it was before, no one even reads about it because that happens every day. That happens all the time. And we don't see the scale of these much smaller infrastructure projects that are going on day in and day out. Now, people are frustrated because they're stuck in traffic. People are frustrated because the roads aren't paved as well. But those are just much smaller projects on an individual basis. So high-speed rail has definitely suffered from that, from being big and from having much more attention associated with it.
And if we look at historically, let's take the Transcontinental Railroad, for example. They pushed through the Sierra Nevada mountains over the course of 2 or 3 years, but almost 1,000 people died. There was disasters. There was not a lot of control. People weren't paid. There were so many effects of not having protections for people. And so it seems like we're trying to do things safer and protect humans, protect the environment. But there's a trade-off to that, which is inefficiency.
Dozens of people died building the Golden Gate Bridge, right? We wouldn't, that kind of human loss and the environmental impact of various projects, I don't think the public would accept these days. And so we have to be aware, like, that's the world we've created. If we want a different world, and if we want a different set of rules, that's on us. And I actually think we're at a pivot moment where there are a number of people in California and in other states who are starting to argue, We have a vision of a different kind of economy, an economy that's less impactful on the environment, economy that produces jobs that are higher wages, but we got to build it. And it's going to take new electrical lines. It's going to take new rail lines. It's going to take these kinds of investments. And maybe we ought to be faster at doing that and still doing it in a way that's respectful of communities and the environment. And we absolutely can. But I think we have to be honest about that there's a set of rules we've created that we might need to adjust in order to be more effective.
And to carry this on a little further, speed equals risk. The faster you do projects, the more errors you run into, the more mistakes you make. And so this is a big project that involves risk. And so that seems like the trade-off that we're making, right?
Yeah, and we're trying to be extremely cautious about each piece. And also some of it is like the complexity of infrastructure that's physical, right? A lot of things have changed very quickly in our society in the last couple of years. Many of them are virtual. And certainly when you make changes in kind of the physical world, building something through someone's property, you got to work with them, you got to negotiate with them, and that takes time. If you're just going to mow straight through and not give them a choice or a voice, that's going to be faster. But that's not going to respect them, their community, the history, and the involvement they've had in that place. And so those are the trade-offs that we've certainly gotten to.
So, Aegon, we know this year in particular is a really pivotal year potentially for the project as state legislators are figuring out the future of cap and trade and whether high-speed rail will be a part of that picture. What's your message that you would wish you could send to state leaders about how they should think about the future of this project?
The state of California needs to recognize that we are not going to get to the carbon neutral economy vision without high-speed rail. We are not going to meet the commitments we have collectively made towards our responsibility to limit climate change. We are not going to have a resilient state economy without high-speed rail. It is fundamentally a part of a future, environmentally thoughtful, equitable type of society that California says that it's about. So we can look at the challenges the project's faced. We can make adjustments to speed up the delivery of it, but we cannot have a future California that meets the goals that have been bipartisan for a number of years, particularly around climate, without an electrified clean rail system. It just will not work with highways and airports and continued expansion of our communities ever outward into wildfire zones and the risk associated with that. So I think that our legislature and our political leaders at the local level and all levels need to embrace that. And they know that when they visit other countries and they see what high-speed rail is and what the experience is. And given that, they should come back and get down and get to work and say, what can we change to make this happen more quickly? We know that we need it. And so high-speed rail has suffered from a debate around, do we need it? Could it be done in other ways? And if we just get beyond that and say, we actually need it, now let's have a conversation about how we can take what we've done and deliver it more quickly. Recognizing a couple of things that are true. It is environmentally cleared. One of the major civil construction projects in the Central Valley has been completed, and there's been the construction of the railhead. So those things are starting to happen. The authority is going to be really focused on limiting efficient use of its limited resources, but trying to really deliver fast and quickly, building on the excellent planning work that's happened in the authority and happened in the individual communities, and maintaining the perspective that this can be done in a way that is still going to be the most environmentally sustainable infrastructure project in the country. That all can still be true if we deliver it more quickly and reduce some of the barriers that we've created for it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I remember when I first took my wife on a high-speed rail in Europe. We were going from London to Paris, and we were like skimming past the French countryside, and she was like, "Man, that'd be so incredible to have something like this at home." I really think, but you sit on one of these trains and you experience it, that's all the persuasion you need.
Yeah, I was at
And
the groundbreaking. in 2015. I just want completion. I want to not live in a construction.
So this is where a bipartisan understanding of learning how to do and deliver big infrastructure projects, this is the one in front of us. But I think we all know there are many other big infrastructure projects we need to do to deal with climate impacts, to deal with, you know, protecting us from wildfires, to make sure that we have the electricity for our communities to continue to grow and evolve and have clean energy. Those are all projects that we have to do, and we need to do many more of. And so I think there's an acceptance that learning how to be that kind of a delivery function is one of the most important political challenges and governance challenges, frankly, for California in the coming years. So high-speed rail is a great place to do it, to demonstrate how we can be effective, because we know the future of California absolutely is going to have a clean train running up and down the state.
We're going to close this podcast where we always close with what we're loving this week. I'll go ahead and start. I have a reputation around the building where I work, and the reputation is around the smell of my lunch. I love sardines. Whenever they go on sale at Costco, I buy them in bulk and I keep them in the kitchen in my workplace, and I'll make sardine sandwiches, throw them in a salad. This week in particular, I was putting some crushed chips in them, in the mixture. It was so good. And sardines are full of protein, full of flavor, full of nutrients. They smell a little bit, which is what brought me the reputation at my workplace. But I am a big sardine advocate. And even a coworker bought me like a little bag, like a little reusable bag that I could carry around that's got little sardines floating on it. So I've become Mr. Sardine at my workplace. Donnie, what are you loving this week?
First of all, A, I don't blame your coworkers if they hate you.
I don't blame them either.
B, I'm sure you follow Allison Roman, who has a lot of recipes that include sardines. Mm-hmm. I have not brought myself to make any of them because I can't stand that they're sardines. I'll go next, even though mine is super boring, but it's just continuing my reputation of being the world's most boring person in my spare time. So I'm really into this new time blocking thing. Do you guys time block on your calendars?
Sometimes.
So I was like, I'm like the type A child that went astray. And so when I was like 7, I was time blocking and like creating little calendars for myself before I went to school about how much time it would take a shower and to get dressed, to eat breakfast and to make my lunch. And then I went astray, and now I'm back to it as a almost 40-year-old. But my day is like literally booked from 6 a.m. till 9 p.m. But it keeps me on schedule because I've already pre-decided everything I have to do. So it's, oh, I have 15 minutes extra on my calendar. What am I going to do? Oh, it's already been decided. You don't have to make any decisions. And just like eliminating decision fatigue is huge for me. So big advocate of time blocking. But I'll probably revolt at some point, and I'll tell our audience about that.
It seems like it's a pendulum thing. You get really organized, but then entropy happens and it goes to disarray.
Absolutely.
What does it feel like to pop a block, to get rid of one of those blocks and just ignore it?
I have to move it. I can't ignore it. You have to just move it to a different day on the calendar. Anyways, it's been great. Super love it.
What are you loving this week?
It's interesting. I love piano and I play jazz piano some. And so I think improvisation is the opposite of the time block planning, Danny, that you're talking about, of living a life of let's see what this comes, let's respond to that a little bit. And sometimes in cooking, one can do that. Let's see what these ingredients we have here and we make a gumbo from it. So I've actually, so two things for me. One is following the food lens. I do love sardines too, but I've been thinking actually more, I love this time of year for the quality of the citrus and the oranges you get, and just constant variety, the acidity, the sweetness, that, you know, the different colors. Some are easier to peel than others. Just the whole experience of wintertime and oranges is I love. I'm also, one of the great changes in the last couple of years is the rise of the audiobook. And so for someone that's out and about a lot, it's hard for me to find the time to sit down in a chair and read a lot of books, but I consume so many more books as audiobooks because you can also change the speed and make them go faster. And podcasts, right? Of that too. So one of the books I'm reading right now is called The Narrow Corridor, States, Societies, and the Fate of Liberty. And it came out a couple of years ago, but I think it's important because it's this idea that where we have a society with a rule, set of a rule of law, where we have some collective agreement on what's going to bind us together, where frankly, we're safer. You go back through most of human history, a lot of environments and places haven't had that. And we've had that in many countries. We've certainly had that in the United States for a couple of hundred years. And this book came out about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I think it's important as we, here we are in California, we've been talking about high-speed rail and how do we make it work. These are hard things. And I think it's okay to acknowledge things that are difficult, but also to really embrace the fact that if we can debate things, if we can disagree about them, debate them, come to an understanding, and then move forward. That's what a democracy is about. And so this book is a little bit on how so many parts of the world for so many times, so many eras of human history, we didn't have that. And there's this sort of narrow corridor that gets us to a place that's fundamentally safe, the rule of law, where democratic decisions can go forward, and frankly, where the people have a check on what decisions that are made by different branches of government, by preventing a king from being too powerful. We've made it real hard to do big things like high-speed rail, but we also can collectively come together and say, all right, if we're agreeing to this fundamentally, let's figure out the right way to do things. So that narrow path of liberty is something I've been thinking about a lot.
Sounds very relevant for today. So this has been a lot of fun. Thank you, Aegon, for joining us to talk about high-speed rail. I think we all learned a lot in this conversation, and I feel a little more optimistic after it, to be honest. I think you think your rah-rah worked on me a bit here as generally someone that's felt fairly pessimistic about this project for a long time. So we really appreciate you stopping by to talk to us.
Well, thanks, Jordan and Donnie. It's been great to be here and look forward to seeing all the work that you continue to do going forward.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.